couple of misconceptions I've had about you all these years until I read the book. I always thought you were a Louisville native, but you're from West Virginia.
Originally,
From the Charleston area.
And then left when I was 23 to go to New York and was up there until I was 30.
And I always thought your real name was Turley Richards, and it's close. It's Richard Turley, right?
Yeah. In the book, it'll tell you that the the manager that I ended up getting, who managed Stan Getz and Mel Torme and a bunch of jazzy-type people, had a form of dyslexic where he would mispronounce, he would turn names around. He wouldn't call you Hallett Rick. Mm-hmm. But any name, like my son is Adam Richards, he would have turned him around to Richards Adam or Richard Adams. So when he introduced me to Stan Getz, he introduced me as, hey, this is my new artist, Turley Richard, no S. And I went over and sat down. I was still sighted then. I went over and sat down while he finished with Stan, and I wrote it down because I'd been wanting to change my name. See, I grew up in West Virginia where Richard is pronounced R-A-Y-I-T-C-H-A-R-D, Rayichard. And I hated it. Rayichard? You know, just hated it, you know. So when I got to New York, I was thinking even going there, you know, with just the name Turley, because there were artists with one name. And when he did that, and he came back, I said, look at this. And he got a little red in the face, told me about, I forgot the word. You ought to have you look at the dyslexic for turning names around. It's some sort of word they use it. But yeah. He looked at it, and I said, boy, it looks good, but what's missing? And he kept looking, and he suddenly leaned down and put the S, and I was born then, 64.
64.
So he's younger than the other guy.
Much younger. So the name of your book is Blind Sighted, and is this something you've been wanting to do for a good while, is write a book?
I hadn't even thought about it. For the last 10 years, I've had so many people, because of all the stories and everything that's happened, they kept saying, you should write a book, and you should write a book, everybody, you know. And finally, this lady in Florida named Linda Durr, I did a podcast radio thing with her, interview. And she said, Turley, would you hang on the line? I want to talk to you as soon as we sign off. So that's when she said it. And then she introduced me to a lady in New York. And their theory was that they felt that I had a story that could be very inspirational. And to people like me who's, you know, does this, is felt, this is what you have to do. I only do what I have to do. I never thought of it as of anything different than what my mom had taught me, to be strong, to be, you know, to never give up, never stop, you know, defeat is no option, all that stuff's in the book. I didn't realize it until my wife, Laura, here, she came on board and started writing with me, you know, editing and straightening, because I had a guy I had been writing with that was kind of a mess, and we had to fix it up. And then we proceeded to finish the last, what, 8 or 9 chapters? And after going through it, it was very hard to write, to go back all those memories. And some of the memories are probably not exact, you know, exactly when it happened and all that, but it's real close. I had a 3-year period where I couldn't remember anything, and that was 68 to 71. That was when I started going blind. They told me I'd be blind in 6 months, and I did carry it a little longer. But if you have 5% vision, are you still sighted? You know, yeah. I mean, come on. So after going through it all, I did realize what they meant. And that's what I'm hoping this book will, you know, that we're going to impart this to other people, that if you just keep on moving, keep on trying, you know, things will work out for you. And so I think that's what the book really means, if it's going to inspire somebody. Well, he did it, and he had no sight. But I can do it, too. That's what we hope.
You're very candid throughout the book about losing your sight, and this dates back to a childhood accident, right?
Yes, at 4 and a half, I was shot with a bow and arrow. I was rushed to the doctor, and the one doctor we wanted to get wasn't available. So we had to get this other guy who turned out to be pretty bad in so many ways. He should have removed the left eye. Now, here's what I was told the difference. The arrow didn't bounce off the eye. It stuck in it. And so he had a 48-hour window for, what's that called, honey, remember? Sympathetic reaction,
mm-hmm.
Which means the left eye had been injured, and in 48 hours, the right eye was going to start trying to take over the left eye. And you're supposed to, if he were removed it within those 48 hours, only about a 1% or 2% chance the right eye would have been affected before it was infected. He left the eye in for 11 months, and it rotted, and all the infection went to the other eye and throughout my body. And at one point, I only had 3 weeks to live. I was so filled up with just, you know, whatever. And they gave me 14 shots a day for 3 weeks of anything they could stick in me, and he saved my life.
Mm.
And said I'd probably have immune problems most of my life, and it would stunt my growth. Well, I'm close to 6'4 and weigh 240. I'm glad it did. I wouldn't want to be blind and 7 foot tall.
Now, this really affected your mother adversely, too, watching you go through all this.
Oh, bless her heart. Yeah, and my father didn't help, and he's an old country boy, and he blamed her, said, you know, if you'd have been watching him, that wouldn't have happened. And it was really tough on her, but that was one powerful, strong lady. Sixth grade education, and she did things with me that would be like Zig Ziglar getting up in front of an audience and making comments. She just, don't ever let anybody treat you like you're handicapped. Don't you ever give up. You keep trying no matter what. You're just like anybody else. You know, she just kept pounding that in me. And she developed a little bit of a son that was a diva. But, but you know, my daughter was talking about, when she's reading it, that all that stuff had happened when I started really going to sing. And I had a record deal at 17. I was being chased around the state by girls because it was the Elvis time. So I was an Elvis replacement until he come to town. But she said, I don't know how a young man went through all of that. It had to be kind of weird, you know, to do that. And she said, it's even more weird because it's my daddy.
Yeah.
And but, yeah, it was there was a lot of stories, a lot of funny things, a lot of sad things, a lot of nutsy things with managers. You know, I was talking to Steve Miller about 8-9 years ago. We were talking about, because I did shows with him, and he said, I don't know how in the hell you slipped through the cracks, man. And I went on to tell him a couple of things. He said, you know, honestly, we could take your name off the top of that page and probably put another 100, 200 names of crazy stuff that happens to us in this business. And he said, you know, if we all, when we walk out on that stage, we give it all. We give 100%. If our managers and our marketing people would do the same, we'd all be successful. But it doesn't happen that way, you know. And so as you read in the book, I don't know if you got that far yet, two crazy mishaps with managers. I mean, well, I can tell the one. The other one, I always have to be careful because I can't be sued, but I don't want to put somebody down on the air. I will, you know, it's in the book. But this one manager in 1970, without my knowing, turned down the David Frost TV show for me to be on four nights a week for a whole year. He wanted to document me going blind and to show the world that this guy was positive acting. This is good for you people, da, da, da. Well, he never even told me about it. I found out a year later through an agent. And a manager's job is to bring the stuff to you and say, here's what's been offered, here's my advice, and then it's up to you to make the decision whether you're going to do it. He took the decision out of my hand.
Mm.
Now, he did turn down Woodstock, but nobody knew what Woodstock was going to be, so I can't really, you know, clobber him for that one. But the Frost Show ought to have been a superstar.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? 14 million homes, four nights a week. And standing up on the couch, too, most of the time, talking.
Now, was it 69 that you were on The Tonight Show?
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah. I think it was October, November, somewhere in that area.
How did that come about?
Just typical. I signed with ICM, which took over the number one booking agency from who I was with before, William Morris. And their TV guy in the TV department kept getting me, you know, I mean, I did Mike Douglas five times. I did Merv Griffin twice, Dick Clark twice. I'm trying to think of some of the shows. I'm leaving somebody out. Johnny Carson, Merv Griffin, Dick Cavett show. I mean, he had me doing all kinds of TV stuff. And so he got the Carson thing. And my first time on the Carson, I didn't even get to sing because Tony Randall stayed so long out front. He had everybody back in the green room. Some big-time stars really angry with him. So they had me to come back. And so the second time back, I was with Woody Allen, who I love, and William Holden. William Holden was kind of a story because I got a Ridgeback dog, a Rhodesian Ridgeback dog, not as a guide, just a pet. And he heard me telling somebody about it, and he came over and said, would you go out to dinner with me after the show? Because the show was usually shot around 6 to 8 o'clock. And he says, I'll tell you the history of the Ridgebacks. And I remember smiling. I said, Mr. Holden, if I didn't go out to dinner with you, my mom would kill me. Then I thought after that, I might have made him mad, made him feel old. But, yeah, I just got it from the agent, you know, and no audition. I just went there, and I was treated fantastically, you know, so.
And did you still have your sight at this time?
No.
No.
Well, in 1972, Marvin Maxwell, a local guy that owns Mom's Musics and all that, played drums on my TV show on HAS. And he said, well, you could see then. I said, well, Marvin, if you set me in a dark room, don't let me know you got one in your hand, and put a flashlight in front of my eyes about 3 inches away, I might see the light. So if that's seeing, then I could see. I think I'm disconcerting. Like right now, I'm looking right in your eyes as I talk to you.
Yeah.
And I do. You notice when I said something to her, I look over at her.
Yeah.
I do all the same mannerisms of someone sighted, and I think that throws people off.
Yeah.
I mean, I watch TV.
Oh, sure. Sure.
You know, I listen to it now. Can't stand to listen to TV, basketball on TV. They don't call the games anymore.
No, no.
Just three guys talk.
Mm-hmm. No, there's
and they got mics, audience mics now, so you can hear the crowd so much. So
yeah.
I have to get it on radio or I can't stand it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a lost. It's going to be a lost art as play-by-play.
Well, you know Van Vance.
Oh, yeah.
He called him very subdued, and I liked the way he did it.
Yeah. It's really an art. There's an art to it. What's your first memory that you had an aptitude for music?
I don't know. You know, it's like when I was 6 and couldn't go to school, I didn't go until I was 8. My dad's plant bought a record player and, a Victrola, because it was 1947, and some 78s. You know, a lot of people don't know what a 78 is. I had to explain it to some, you know, the had the boy Shane. What it was, it's a, you know what 78 is.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, so it was a single, one on each side, but they bought me 20 records. Well, that was 47, so the big music at the time was a big band. So my mom and I went over to a Five and Dime store, which you don't hear of anymore, and bought, it was the first year the kazoos came out shaped like an instrument. Well, I didn't know what a saxophone was, but I liked the way this thing felt in my hands. So Mom said 2 to 3 hours every day during school that I'd be in the other room playing the big band stuff, going, and I didn't even think of that being my formal training because that's what it was when I decided to start singing around 12 to 13. The crazy thing is that my pitch was perfect. My timing was perfect because, see, I'd been pretending to be all these different instruments. The bass took a solo, I went do down on the thing. And then that's what also turned me into being praised by a lot of people as being a really good scat singer. You know what scatting is?
Oh, sure, yeah.
And so, but that was, I started playing a guitar, trying to play. I took one lesson and realized I couldn't take lessons because I couldn't see good enough to what they needed me to see. And so I just finished teaching myself. And the first time to realize that it was looking pretty good as I sang at my school in the 9th grade. And then I got, they integrated our school that year. I got 4 black kids with me, and we formed a group called the Five Pearls. It was me singing lead, playing guitar, and then the 4 black kids singing all the do-do-do-do-do-do-do, you know, all that stuff. And so that started really knocking everybody out. We sang at the different other schools and all that. And then in the 10th grade's when I started playing with a band called the first band, the Crystals. And it's just me and a drummer and a guitar player. So just two guitars and drums, no bass. And then the next group was the Travelers, but I started appearing on the Dick Reed Show, which was a clone of the Dick Clark Show.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty cool the way that worked out, because then I started going throughout the state. And that's where the phrase was coined, the West Virginia Superstar, because mm-hmm. I was a young kid, 16. Then I got my first record deal at 17. So when I really started feeling it, I don't know, I think it just... I was such a good basketball player. If I could have seen a little bit better, I would have played for sure. If I'd have had both eyes, I'd have been All-State, I have no doubt. Because I was a heck of a ball player. I only had one eye, and it wasn't even good. My brother Frank was a All-State basketball.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was pretty cool. And music kind of came, I looked at music. I'll meet some girls with my music. So it's funny. In some ways, as crazy as this sounds, the blindness robbed me of my athletic life and career that I wanted, even the bad eyes. And I was resented music for a long time. I loved to do it, but I resented it all I could be as a singer, not my basketball player. Or pole shark, which I was, until I went blind. That's Mickey. You know Mickey Clark?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that's Mickey. He'll tell you.
You've written a lot of songs over the years. Do you have a favorite?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, I've written close to 700. One about my kids that I've never performed live. It's called Let Me See.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked a song called Train Back to Mama. I like one I have right now. It's on the CD.
Mm-hmm.
What Am I Gonna Do? And I actually like my song called West Virginia Superstar. But American Dream, which I'm going to play for you today, that's one of my favorites. But I've got so many different styles. The biggest downfall of my career, and it sounds kind of funny, is that I can sing any kind of music fairly good, fairly well, or however you want to word that. And I've also written that way. So I've got songs written that are in jazz form. Got them written to James Taylor. Got them written in serious R&B stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I don't know if I could actually pinpoint one song. Can you? That I've said I like.
Hmm? Of course, you didn't write Voice of Jesus.
Yeah, I didn't write the.
Oh, I thought you wrote that one.
No, that was written in 1881.
Oh, I didn't know.
It's my arrangement of it. Uh-huh. So they give you under the PD law, they give you the rights of arrangement money.
Was that your biggest hit or your most successful?
No.
No.
1970 was the Bob Dylan song, Love Minus Zero, went top 50 Billboard. And then in 1980, You Might Need Somebody, went top 50 Billboard. And I didn't write either one of them. That tells you something. All my songs. But I learned a lot about writing, too, during that time. And, of course, now my career now, along with the book and going back out to sing again, is that I'm a vocal coach, and I've done really well with quite a few of my students. As a matter of fact, one made it this year to The Voice, Allison Bray. Last year, Olivia Henkin made it there.
Mm-hmm.
And then over at Idol, Brandy Neely made it. So that was three students of mine that made it that far up.
Now, you've made a lot of show business acquaintances over the years. You tell a great story about meeting Richard Pryor after you moved to New York.
Yeah, Richard and I got real tight. We used to, we did those shows, probably 42 of them, at the Cafe Wa. And we, on that same bill was Richie Havens and David Fry. I don't know what happened to them. Anyway, Richard was a great guy. He was a very sad individual, grew up horrible, lived in a brothel, and he had to live in that, growing up. But a funny guy. I'd say three times a week, twice a week from that show, we'd go out afterwards, and we were down in Greenwich Village.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have breakfast and talk and learn a lot about each other.
There's a picture of you in the book with Joe Walsh. It looks like 1993. And I think it's back when Joe was still partying.
Oh, yeah.
He looks a little rough in that, but that was another one of your friends that you made in the music.
Yeah,
business.
Joe and I were going to do an album together. He had he was doing an article, not an article. Yeah, he was a featured person in Playboy. And they mentioned his favorite singer or some great singer, whatever name he put with it, and tremendous producer, Turley Richards. So I was in a studio in Nashville producing something, and somebody came over and said, "Hey, you're in Playboy magazine." I did not take my clothes off for anybody. So they told me Joe Walsh had said something. So then I had to do the procedure of trying to locate how to talk to him. And finally got with him, and I flew out to California. We jammed and talked, and he wanted to do something. So we talked to Joe Smith, who was the president of Elektra, and he was going to give us $50,000 to go do 3 songs. And if he liked what he heard, he would do a whole album and, you know, give us another couple of $100,000. And they threw money away a lot in those days. Mm-hmm. And we were all set. We had 3 songs. We needed a 4th song. And we were working on a 4th song when Joe disappeared off the face of the earth for almost 2 or 3 years. He went through some traumatic things family-wise that I won't divulge here. Mm-hmm. But it never came to fruition.
No, yeah.
But I do enjoy him when I'm around him. And he once said to me, "If I could sing like you and you could play like me, we'd be a monster." And I said, "No, if I could sing like you and you played like me, we wouldn't be as good, but we'd be big stars because the mass can't hear." He's a funny guy.
So why don't you go ahead and play something for us now before we wrap it up?
This song here is, I've had probably 4 different arrangements of it through the years, but this has a little bit of the R&B and blues to it. I don't know if my guitar is going to be too loud or not.
That's okay. I think you're good.
Okay. So. Circles trying to make ends meet. I've got 4 hungry children that somehow I got to feed. Inflation everywhere. I can't find a job.
Make it through tomorrow.
All right. The name of the book is Blindsided, Turley Richards. Well, thanks so much for joining us. And Laura, thank you as well.
Thank you, Rick. I hope I can come back sometime.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.